Thank you, Linda. Right, first problem is, where's that gone? As Linda mentioned in her introduction, this is the third talk in this Lepidoptera series. Malcolm gave that overview of morphology and phylogeny of Lepidoptera, which I won't particularly go into in any further detail today. And Gaydon did what essentially was the bottom half of the Lepidoptera. I'll be dealing largely with the top half, the Macrolepidoptera. In particular, we're looking at four superfamilies. The first one, the Bombycoids, include hawk moths, silk moths, owl moths like this one, monkey moths, and various small families such as the Pentaglory and Dromus. We have the Noctuoid here, including the owlet, the underwing, processionary caterpillars, prominence, tiger moth, and tussocks. There's the geometroid complex, predominantly just including a variety of other smaller families. Few people actually know about. And the fourth one are butterflies. Now, the butterflies, there is so much known about them in terms of their biology, their natural history, their ecology, that they could, perhaps should, have a talk devoted to them alone. So, although I will be drawing some examples through this talk from butterflies, I am predominantly drawing my examples from the macro moths, and unashamedly, a lot of the pictures are of hawk moths. So what are Macrolepidoptera? Well, just to briefly go over the higher classification of the Lepidoptera, such that it is, and it hasn't changed much from this, it's about 15 years old now. This is more or less the region that Gaydon was talking about, the lower Lepidoptera, including from the clothes moths up to the plume moths there. I'm within that final branch on the end, the Obtectomera, and here we have the Macrolepidoptera. As you can see, the four major superfamilies. We have the Bombycoids, over there the Noctuoids, the Geometroids, and the butterflies, and as I said, a few other things. Now, what I want to do first of all is to give you what might be called a caricature of a Macrolepidoptera. The sort of idea that most people who are not particularly familiar with I'm going to for the sake of argument, we will start with the eggs. Macrolepidopteran eggs are spherical, green, and laid singly on the underside of a leaf. When the first instar caterpillar hatches out, it usually eats its way out through the top of the egg. It then eats the entire eggshell before moving off to feed on the leaf that its mother has conveniently laid it on. It then continues to eat these leaves for 5 instars. And the main job description, if you like, of a caterpillar is just to pile on the pounds. It's there to turn this, which is about 4 or 5 millimeters long, into this in about 4 weeks. And that is, in fact, the fully grown larva of the previous first instar. As you can see, it's camouflaged. The reason that it's camouflaged, green with stripes, with counter shading, is because it's very edible. This is a very nice meal for a bird or So it's camouflaged. It's not hairy, it's fairly smooth. Very small spines. Once it's finished feeding, it then climbs down off the food plant, goes in search of somewhere to pupate, often walking quite a long way. Some of them burrow into the ground. They can go down anything from a centimetre or so to over a foot down. And there they make themselves an earthen chamber, which they line very briefly with silk. Or they will spin leaves together in order to make a very rude cocoon. Above the ground, or actually within the leaf. And the silk is produced in the spinneret in the center of the pterygial complex, which is one of the unique features of Lepidoptera. The pupa itself is fairly uninteresting. It's a fusiform shape. That word obtectomera I mentioned earlier on refers to the fact that all of the appendages, the wings, the legs, the antennae, are all stuck down onto the surface of the pupa, so they're not, you can't lift them up to look underneath. There's very little by way of ornamentation, and at the back end here, there is a cremaster which will often have just a few hooks on to hold it in place within its earthen cell or its little leaf cocoon. Within here, the larval tissues break down, and the developing adult tissues use that as nutrients to produce the adult moth. When the adult moth is ready to emerge, it moves up through the ground, actually still in the pupal case, and once it reaches the surface, it emerges, climbs up the nearest vertical surface, expands its wings, and then flies off. Like the caterpillar, Macrolepidopteran adults are edible, and so they're very well camouflaged. There is a moth in this picture. If you look very carefully, you can just about make out the stripes around the edges of the wing. The head is about there, the leading edges are up and down there. If you're not going to, you've got to hide. So what do they do? Well, when night comes, if you like, the real caricature of moth, they just fly around drinking nectar from flowers, having a whale of a time, until it comes to adult moth, which is needless to say, reproduction. The females call males using pheromones produced from a gland towards the tail, and the males, being relatively stupid and sex mad, flies in, and it's the first male who gets there who wins the right to mate. If several males arrive at the same time, then a bit of an orgy ensues, and this is the vapor moth, living up to its name of Orgyia. The female is this poor little wingless thing stuck in the middle of these three males. We're not fighting each other so much as just trying to get their bits in the right place at the right time first. And of course, eventually, one of them does. Mating can last half an hour, I guess, several hours. And then the female goes off, lays her eggs singly on the food plant, and the whole thing starts again. That is what amounts to the caricature of Macrolepidopteran. If you looked at the average Macrolepidopteran, that is what they do. That is why, as I say, there are 90,000 ways to eat a leaf and drink nectar. And to most people, that's all there is to Lepidoptera. And if you think of that, I can stop now. But I want to now run through those of you who have asked me various other aspects of biology of Lepidoptera that make them, to me, the most interesting of the orders. Far more interesting than the things that other people here might work on. Controversial, but there again, I must agree with you. So let's start back at the beginning again with eggs. Well, eggs, well, they don't exactly behave, do they? I mean, an egg is an egg. I've never seen an egg in my fridge behave very much. So there are limited amounts of things that I can talk about with regard to eggs, but one of them is that if you feed on a very large plant, or alternatively, you can eat virtually anything, then it perhaps makes sense for the female moth to lay in batches rather than individually, particularly if she herself doesn't feed and doesn't have a lot of time to live. And this is a lackey moth egg batch wrapped around a twig, because these overwinter as eggs, so if they laid them on leaves, they'd drop off onto the ground and the leaf would rot away long before the eggs hatched. So they wrap them around a twig in order to see them through the winter. This, if you like, is a flat array of eggs. The map butterfly goes upwards, or actually downwards. These are little columns of eggs, all laid one on top of the other, stacking up. And if you remember, I said that the first instar caterpillar tends to hatch out by eating its way through the top of the egg. Well, in fact, unless these develop in a very particular order, which they don't, the bottom ones would be actually eating their way up through the ones above them. And that's, of course, not what happens. They eat their way out sideways. You can put them that way, you can put them that way. So why not do both? Let's build walls with eggs. This is a Bombycid, a triloca, stolen from Malcolm Scobel's book, incidentally. And you can see the lateral exits where the caterpillars have come out, because they're clearly not all developing in the order that they were laid. Eggs just laid bare like that are quite vulnerable to predators and to parasitoids, so some female moths take the time to protect them. And this is a good example. This is the brown tail moth, which actually covers its eggs with a patch, with a covering of hairs from a tuft at the end of her tail. A carithrogyne, to those who want long Latin words. And this is, in fact, an example, a remarkable example of protection through a life cycle. Because what happens in this group is that the caterpillars are hairy with poisonous spines. Anyone who's brushed up against a brown tail in the south of England will know what I'm talking about here. The spines are barbed, they're full of antihistamines, proteolytic enzymes, they make you itch like hell. And if they get into your eyes, it's a rather nasty operation in an eye hospital to get them out one at a time. When the caterpillar's full grown, it spins a cocoon and it incorporates those hairs into the cocoon and protects the pupa the same way. When the female moth hatches out, she rubs her anal tuft here through across the cocoon, picking up these hairs, thereby protecting her, and eventually she puts them on top of the eggs to protect them. So the hairs of the caterpillar protect the entire life cycle, very economical. And of course, as I mentioned, caterpillars can be poisonous. If you're going to sit around a long time on a leaf eating it, and caterpillars are not the most agile of animals, it's not as if they can get up and fly away or run away at high speed. They've got to protect themselves some other way. And if it's not going to be camouflage, you might as well cover yourself in lots of poisonous spines. Anybody who's been to Santa Rosa and sat on the benches underneath the trees around the canteen there might have been blissfully unaware of the relatives of this thing eating away up in the canopy above. When I was there, I remember one of these, a Hylesia, dropped down the back of Ian Gould, and I've never seen him jump up so quickly. These are really nasty animals. I can prove it even further with this, which says, warning, these specimens bear highly toxic spines, do not open. This is Lonomia acalus. This is another one of these Hemilucine saturnians from Brazil. These go around living in colonies that happen to be about that high on tree trunks. And these caterpillars have got not only antihistamines and proteolytic enzymes and all sorts of nasty things in there, they will break down your blood vessels. So you put your hand on one of these and you start within a few minutes bleeding from all your mucous membranes. From your eyes, your ears, your nose, your mouth, your intestines, everywhere. And if you've got low blood pressure, or if you're hemophiliac, you can die. These caterpillars can kill people. There is another way of protecting yourself. If you're not going to put on a cloak of armour, so to speak, hire some mercenaries. And this is, of course, what a lot of Lycaenid butterflies do. The mercenaries in question are, of course, the best fighters in the animal kingdom, the ants. And this is one of the European large blues. This is the one where the caterpillar is taken by the ants down into the colony, where it quite happily chews its way through the ants' larvae, and in return it gives the ants honeydew, a sugary solution that it secretes from the back end. It secretes it from what's called a dorsal nectary organ, which is this giant pair of lips towards the tail of the caterpillar. But not all Lycaenid caterpillars have the advantage of being taken into an ant's nest for protection. A lot of Lycaenids live outdoors still on the leaves, chewing away. And they need a way of calling the ants to them when they're being attacked. Most of them do it by scent. They have these things called pore cupuli, which actually secrete a pheromone that is very similar, if not identical, to the ant alarm pheromone. So you prod one of these caterpillars, it sends out the ant alarm pheromones, and the ants, being the robots or the automata that they are, respond by running around madly, clacking their jaws and doing what the ants do best. And the caterpillar gains protection as a result. Not everybody does it by scent, however. There are some caterpillars that call ants literally. This is Thisbe irene, and on the projecting from the front of the thorax are these modified hairs with ridges. And on the top of the head, there are some knobbly spines. And when the caterpillar's annoyed or irritated, it moves its head in and out and rubs these spines, these ridges, over the knobs on the head. Now, those of you who were here almost 20 years ago will remember that it was Phil de Vries who did this work. And at a meeting, he demonstrated how this system worked. I was thinking about recreating the demonstration here, but unfortunately one of the two participants didn't make it. So instead, what we've got, I'm afraid, is something I stole off my son this morning, and it literally works like that. Phil apparently has nowhere near as much hair as he appears to have in that picture, at least not now. Of course, once you're into an ant colony, in some ways you can do away with feeding, with helping the ants. I mean, why bother giving them a reward if, like this Lephira larva, you can just turn yourself into a tank? This is the head of the caterpillar hiding under here. There's two of the legs. This is an incredibly armoured upper carapace, which the ants try desperately to bite their way into or to turn the caterpillar over, but fail miserably. And the caterpillar just chews its way through the ant larvae in the nest, oblivious to what the ants are trying to do about it. The pupa is protected in the same way, and when the adult actually hatches out, it's covered in loose, sticky scales that, when the ants try to bite it, clogs up their mandibles while the butterfly makes its escape. That was a caterpillar that eats ant larvae. There are caterpillars that eat other things. In Hawaii, there are geometric caterpillars, genus Eupothecia and relatives. They look like normal geometric caterpillars. They're green, they're twig-like, they sit out at an angle, but at the back end, the seti there, are extremely sensitive to touch. And as soon as a Drosophila or a Tephritid fly touches those, the caterpillar whips round, grabs it, and starts eating it alive. And it grabs it with these large modified front legs that it's got. There are caterpillars in Britain that do the same thing, or at least eat other caterpillars, the Dunbar moth being the most well known. And this led one person, in fact, at one point to argue that caterpillars and Lepidoptera in general are actually plants, because it was clear that by eating other caterpillars, even caterpillars couldn't tell the difference between plants and caterpillars, and therefore caterpillars must be plants. If you ever want more twisted logic, the book is Butterfly Miracles and Mysteries by Ackworth. Well worth a read if you think, whenever you're really down and think that things can't get any worse. Living by yourself is also dangerous. If you're the only one out there and the predator spots you, you're dead. There's safety in numbers. And this is Eukaira socialis in Australia. And they build themselves a nice nest out of silk. Nothing can get into this. This is an incredibly tough silken shell. And they sit in there by day, hiding from the birds and the lizards and the like, and they come out at night to eat the leaves of the tree in which they're living. Other caterpillars come out in a more orderly fashion. I like to think of this as sort of the caterpillar equivalent of the beer crawl in Falaraki. They just follow the guy at the front blindly, regardless of where he happens to be going. They come out and they demolish the trees that they're feeding on. They're so dangerous that, in fact, this is from the Spanish Ministry of Agriculture website. As you can see, responsible for killing thousands of pines, it's armed and dangerous, because not only is this thing eating its way through the pine forests of southern Spain, but it's one of these hairy, toxic caterpillars as well. And it's responsible for urticaria in tourist areas in southern Spain. However, it is still not the most important in terms of numbers and damage. That accolade goes to armyworms. Now, armyworms are called armyworms for exactly that reason. There are millions of them in an outbreak, and they will just move across a field eating everything green in it. And the same in numbers. I mean, if a bird comes down and eats that one, well, what does it matter to the other guys here? There are millions of these things. But they're still, as you can see, green and striped. And although camouflage isn't exactly a great thing in this particular instance, if they were living by themselves, they would still need that camouflage because they're edible. But if you're feeding on a toxic plant, it doesn't make sense to detoxify it or detoxify the poisons or just pass them straight through you and not use them. So a lot of caterpillars will sequester poisons, put them into their own tissues, and make use of them that way, and then advertise the fact that they're not edible by warning coloration such as this South American hawk moth. This is feeding on a plant called Allamandra cathartica. Cathartica means purgatory, not in the biblical sense, but in the sense of clearing you out from one end to the other in 10 minutes flat, should you happen to eat it. It's Apocynaceae. And caterpillars use this feature in their own defense. Not only does that plant make us vomit, but they do it in defense as well. You pick up one of these Hyles caterpillars. These feed on spurges. Spurges have nasty chemicals in them called furanocoumarins. Furanocoumarin plus UV light means your DNA is absolutely trashed. A caterpillar is essentially a tube with a gut running down the middle. That gut is full of plant. 50%, Ackworth was possibly correct in some sense. 50% of this caterpillar really is plant. It's what's going through its gut. So when you pick one of these up, the first thing they do is flip round, vomit it all back onto you. Spurge juice is very sticky. It's very poisonous. If you've got one of these in your mouth and it flicks from side to side, you get a very nasty surprise. I can tell you from experience that it actually also is very difficult to wash off in some cases. And these are the caterpillars I don't let my kids pick up. Finally, caterpillars can try to look like something completely different. And I don't mean this in the sense of looking like twigs and leaves and grass. How about looking like snakes? Normally, when it's unmolested, this Hemiplanes caterpillar is quite camouflaged with these pale grey and black patches. But disturb it, it twists over, it expands the first abdominal segment to show these two big false eyes, pulls its legs in, rears up, expels air from its spiracle so it starts hissing, and then it starts striking, just like a small pit viper, which is exactly what it's pretending to be. And if you come across one of these naively, as it were, they are very, very convincing. They will actually even hit you with their head during the strike. But what about pupae? Well, the pupae are like eggs. They don't do very much. In a sense, their behavior is a product of either what the caterpillar did before or what the adult is going to do afterwards. Some of them build rude cocoons among leaves, but some go further. They build these elaborate cocoons. This is an emperor moth from Britain. It's got a very tough outer shell, waterproof, predator-proof. Inside, there is a second layer, which is much softer, that the pupa will actually sit in quite comfortably. And there is an escape hatch at the top, made of overlapping filaments, which will allow the moth to force its way out, but not allow anything to get in. Some butterflies hang around, shall we say. The pupae will hang by that cremaster from under leaves, and most of them are camouflaged as bits of dead twig and the like. This Euplea pupa is an exception. It's got a perfectly mirror finish to it. And the theory goes, although I'm not absolutely convinced, that the idea of a mirror finish is to reflect the surroundings randomly and thereby blend in. But when you see these pupae on trees in Australia that have dropped their leaves, they look nothing more than like nature's Christmas tree decorations, and they stand out remarkably well. So what the function of this mirror surface really is, we don't know. And of course, you can then combine these two. You can make yourself a cocoon and then you can hang it from the branch. So there are all sorts of variations. Otherwise, we're left with the ones that are underground. And some of these have quite elaborate means of getting out. And this is what it is. If you're 6 feet down, oh, sorry, 6 inches down underground, you've got to force your way out. The more hooks and spines and whatever you can have to get purchase coming up, the better. And things like Neocasiteus here have patches on the back of very sharp spines. If you rub these over the inside of your arm, they will actually take the top of your skin off. And if you put the pupa on the ground and irritate it, it'll quite happily wriggle away at quite a speed. But essentially, that's all there is to pupae. With the adults, however, we now start getting into the real interesting stuff. And the real interesting stuff is really there because real interesting stuff is linked to sex. Always is. When I gave you the caricature, I said that the female moth calls the male with pheromones, and the first male to arrive is the successful one, and that's how she gauges how good or bad he is. The first one there is the best. Not sure how many of the girls and men in the audience accepted the first little kid who turned up on their doorstep and then she just turned to three. You exercise what's called female choice, and so do moths and butterflies. So the male has to prove himself. He has to prove he's the right species, and he has to prove that he's better than the next butterfly or the previous one that she met. A lot of them do it with pheromones. This is a pair of Danaid hair pencils that they keep in the back end of the abdomen. Danaid males have pouches on the wings in which they produce pheromones. They have special hairs in there that break up into little particles to carry the pheromones. They put these hair pencils into the pouch, pick up the pheromones, and then dust them onto the female's antenna during courtship. It's not always the female, however, who calls the males. Males can call females. This is creatinota, so it's several creatinotas. And these are the cremata, the scent-producing organs of the male moths. And these male moths hang around in leks. They all hang from different branches in the same general area, all displaying their cremata here. And in this case, it turns out that the best is the moth with the biggest. The most well-endowed moth is the one that the female likes. Size, in this particular case, does matter. So the female moths fly into this lek, they look around, as it were, find the males with the largest cremata and mate with them. So how come these poor little underendowed guys manage to persist in the population? Well, it turns out that the reason is quite simple. Not all females make it to the party in time. Some of them are late. And the ones that are late, of course, these guys are all taken, so to speak. The only ones who are left are the little wallflowers sitting in the corner. But there's so much pheromone floating around in the air that in some sense they don't seem to notice. And so these guys eventually, if they wait long enough, will mate. The kick in the tail of this is that the size of these organs is dictated by what the caterpillar eats. The pheromone precursors that these moths use come from chemicals in their larval food plants. And the more chemicals there are in the larval food plants, the bigger these organs are in the moth. So this one was feeding on plants as a caterpillar that had a lot of these chemicals, but this one was feeding on plants with virtually no chemicals. So it's also in the female's interest, ultimately, to lay her eggs on the correct plant to ensure that her sons will be successful, although as it turns out it's not necessarily always necessary to be the case. You can't. You don't just do it with scent. You can do it like the caterpillars did with the ants. You can do it by sound. And these are moth stridulatory organs on the genitalia. They have modified scales on the valves, and they have modified scales on the end of the abdomen. And by rapidly rotating their genitalia, they will make a noise a bit like a grasshopper. But beyond that, we don't know exactly how they use it. It all happens at night, it all happens in the tropics, and it's a completely open field as to how these structures are actually used in courtship. Coming back to that caricature again, the typical, if you like, Macrolepidopteran is camouflaged, edible and camouflaged. But if you're going to sequester poisons to protect the caterpillar, then it makes sense evolutionarily to carry that through to the adult stage. If you carry it through to the adult stage, you can then display that poisonous nature at that time, like this cinnabar moth is doing, and it gives rise to warning coloration. Of course, if every single species had a different pattern, then the predators would have to learn an awful lot of different patterns as well. So it makes sense then to consolidate down and for different species, if you like, to use the same pattern. This is exactly what happens in Müllerian mimicry. These three, top right, middle left, bottom right, are all three members of the genus Amoris, milkweed butterflies from Africa. They're different species, but the colour patterns are almost identical. These are Müllerian mimics because all three species are poisonous and they're sharing the same colour pattern. Of course, there will be cheats in any system like this, and this is exactly what happens. Down here we have a swallowtail, as far as we know, perfectly edible, but pretending not to be. Top left is a hypolimnus, a nymphalid butterfly, which is probably edible, but we're not sure. And the jury is still out on the Pseudocrea, yet another subfamily of butterflies, which may or may not be poisonous. We're not at the moment certain whether this one is a Müllerian mimic or a Batesian mimic. These are the ones that effectively are cheating the system. Just like the caterpillars were trying to look like snakes, looking like some completely different organism, then some moths do the same. This is the Caspis, another hawk moth, which is a very good mimic of carpenter bees, to the point that they have yellow coloration on the thorax that mimics the reflection of from the top of the bee's head. They have patches of light-colored scales down the back, which mimic the reflection from the back of the bee. And in fact, male and female Xylocopas, carpenter bees, one of them has a yellow patch on the thorax, and the males have yellow patches on the thorax and the females don't. And coincidentally, the male moths have yellow patches on their thorax and the male bee, the female moth mimics the female bee. Now, okay, it's a 50-50 chance that it was going to work out like that, but it is nevertheless an interesting coincidence. And these moths fly by day, feed from the same flowers as the Xylocopas, they make much the same sort of noise, and they're very, very common. Very difficult to decide when you want to swipe a net at one of these things as to what you're going to end up with. And if you make the mistake and stick your hand into a net that's got the bee, not the moth, you very quickly find out what the problem is. Going back to the caricature again, moths fly around drinking nectar from flowers, and most of them will land on the flower to do that. If you land on the flower, however, you're exposing yourself to all sorts of predators that might be sitting on that flower or nearby, lizards, spiders and the like. So hawk moths here take one way out, and they effectively stand off. They're one of the only three groups of organisms that feed from flowers while hovering. Hummingbirds and flower bats are the other. And they've got a long tongue that means they can reach into the flower but still stand well back from anything that might be sitting on it. However, whenever you get in nature, the opposite side, the predator, always tries to fight back, and this is exactly what the spider did. Here we have a spider sitting on Lantana, using, with its legs up, using the hairs on its legs to detect the downdraft of the gas that was the moth is in. When the moth is close enough, it jumps. And it jumps onto the back of the moth. Now the moth is free flying. So moth and spider fall down, and the only reason they don't hit the ground is that the spider has already tagged a silken thread behind it. The spiders are effectively hunting on bungee ropes. Not just little spiders, big ones. To give you an idea of how big this is one of the world's largest hawk moths, Neocasiteus. The body length is 4 inches, 10 centimetres. The spider has a leg span that would go over your hand. The moth weighs about 2.5 grams, the spider wears something similar, and it's all being held on one set of silken threads. And in fact, these spiders often go down before, if you like, the elasticity kicks in and they're slowed down. So how do hawk moths battle back against this sort of problem? Well, it's very difficult to hit a moving target. This is a dorsal view. This is a view looking down on a hawk moth. You can see the tongue never moves out of the flower, but the moth is moving backwards and forward, or left and right, should I say. And of course, if it's doing that remarkably quickly, the spider has no idea of where it's going to jump. If it jumps and misses, it's a long way down, or at least it's a couple of feet down. Spiders are not the only predators out there at night. Of course, the big ones are bats. Bats eat an awful lot of Lepidoptera. So the Lepidoptera, needless to say, have got various ways of battling with this. When we build our military fighter aircraft and bomber aircraft, we go in for stealth technology. The idea is to make the radar signature of the plane as small as possible so you can't see it. These moths might go in for what is called anti-stealth. They try to be as big as possible. And the way that these do it is that they've got long tails, and at the end, there are little paddles that are twisted. So when these moths fly, these tails are twisting out big cones in the air behind them. And to a bat sonar, these look solid. And so the moth appears incredibly large, and the bat doesn't attack. And recent work has shown that, in fact, large Saturnians like this seem never to be eaten by bats. So maybe it works. You can cheat, if you like, to get away from bats, and you can fly by day. And this is what the butterflies and a lot of moths have done. But of course, my mother would say, you swap a fiddle for a gewgaw by doing this, because you may leave the bats behind and the spiders behind, but you go out into the world of birds and lizards and other visually oriented predators. If you stay behind, as it were, at night, then what an advantage you would have if you could hear the bats coming. Bats hunt by sonar, and for the bat to detect a moth, the signal has to travel to the moth and then back. The moth, on the other hand, to hear the bat, only has to hear the signal arrive. So all other things being equal, the moth should be able to hear the bat twice as far away as the bat can hear it. And this is what appears to be what happens. A lot of moths have ears. These are the tympanal organs of noctuoids. And it's probably not coincidental that the three largest superfamilies of moths, the pyraloids, the geometroids, the noctuoids, each with over 35,000 species so far, all have ears. It seems to give them an incredible evolutionary advantage. And when they hear the bats coming, they will take evasive action. They will dive down, they will turn off at an angle, and in some cases they'll just close up their wings and fall to the ground. Now that's all well and good for the edible species. Now what about these ones that are poisonous, like the tiger moth right at the beginning? If you're flying by night, bright colours aren't going to help you. Certainly not going to help a bat tell you know that that you're poisonous. So tiger moths have gone about telling bats that they're poisonous. When they detect a bat signal coming in, they shout back at the moth, shout back at the bat. They've got timbal organs. This is a region of flexible cuticle on the side of the thorax with a series of ridges, and when the muscle inside pulls on that, it deforms those ridges repeatedly in sequence to produce a buzzing noise. And studies have shown that when bats hear this buzzing noise, they break off their attack. Now, whether that's because they've learned that the buzzing noise means it's poisonous, or rather more esoterically, whether the moths are actually jamming the bat's sonar, is not quite clear yet. But certainly this is acoustic aposematism. Back to feeding again. Moths feed and butterflies drink nectar from flowers. Well, nectar, frankly, is not a very good food source. It's pretty low in sugar, 5% or thereabouts, and it's pretty abysmal in things like amino acids and vitamins and all the other sorts of things that organisms need. So some moths get a sort of a power drink, if you like, 10%, 15% sugar, by attacking fruits. And they've got strongly reinforced proboscises that they will puncture through the surface of a fruit, and they can go through mangoes, these are guavas, even oranges, and suck the juice directly out of the oranges. That's fine for sugars. What about vitamins and minerals? Well, a lot of butterflies mud puddle, what's called mud puddling. They go down to the stream side and they will drink from the stream side where evaporation has concentrated the salts that are in the water. But then some nocturnal moths have discovered that there is a better source of salty solutions out there, and that's tears. And this is an orthodontid moth sticking its proboscis under the lower eyelid of Hans Banziger in Thailand and drinking his tears. And these moths, all moths have, all butterflies as well, have touch organs on the end of the proboscis that tell them where it is in space. In these particular moths, these touch organs are reinforced, sharpened and turned into barbs, and these actually scrape their proboscis across the surface of the eyeball to irritate it in order to make the tears flow more freely. And just to add to everything, they can carry viruses that will transmit diseases as well. So whether Hans here is advancing science or being incredibly stupid, I've never quite worked out. Of course, you can get sugar solutions from fruits, you can get salt solutions from tears. There is a liquid out there that will combine everything. It's high protein, high sugar, high everything. The dipterists know what it is. Blood. And this is a vampire moth, Calyptra eustrigata. It's derived from, it's a relative of one of those that feeds on fruit, but instead of sticking its proboscis into fruit, it sticks its proboscis into mammals. And in this case, Hans Banziger's finger. He says it is like having a hot, red hot needle stuck into your hand. It's not painless. But if you have a close look at the end of the proboscis, this is full of rasping hooks and cutting blades. Really nasty piece of work. So far, we don't think that they transmit any diseases, which is probably their only saving grace. Finally, a little bit of controversy. An ooh-ah picture. It's difficult, perhaps, if you cast off your scientific mind and look at it as perhaps a young kid might, to look at that and with the pseudo pupil apparently looking back at you and not think that there's something in there saying, "Who are you looking at, mate?" Most moths and butterflies are not actually that intelligent, but some hawk moths are. Gaydon will recognise the photograph. The rest of you will when it comes out on the cover of Systematics and Biodiversity shortly. This is a striped hawk moth, which is feeding from flowers in Mark O'Neill's kitchen. You can also get these moths to feed from artificial sources, such as this golf tee. And what Mark has found is that he used to come back at the same time every day and feed these moths as soon as he got in. And he found that just like some birds and some squirrels, if they're fed regularly at the same time every day, will get to know that that's the time of day that they're to be fed and they will be sitting there waiting, so were these moths. If he was late, he'd walk into the room and they'd be hovering there. They'd come up to him and hover at about eye level, effectively saying, come on, where's lunch? Where's dinner? You're late. Took them about 4 or 5 days to catch on to this. So maybe some of these moths are actually at least as intelligent as squirrels and sparrows, and who knows what else they might be capable of. So I started this talk by giving you a caricature of Macrolepidoptera as a whole. Caterpillars that sat around hiding on leaves, eating them when they could, and turning into light, airy, fairy creatures that didn't really do much with their days. I hope that through the second part of the talk, I've convinced you that there's more to Lepidoptera than Macrolepidoptera than this, and that in fact, some of them can be quite dangerous. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ian. That was absolutely fascinating. A wonderful tour of the macro moths. And even if it didn't quite cover 90,000, I'm sure you got jolly close to it. And I was particularly impressed with your claims of the intelligence of the hawk moth, but I'm sure that geometric moths could be trained to be as well as the practice. Anyway, that's great, and I hope that we have some questions from the audience, please. If Ian would like to take the questions, and please repeat the question briefly for the sake of the recording. Any questions?
How many moths taken to deceiving banks, non-poisonous moths, just by making an appropriate response?
It's difficult to know because everyone, of course, does the research on the interesting ones that have something done. If you go into West Africa, this idea of what do moths other than the responding ones do, you will find bat roosts that have got absolutely carpeted underneath with moth wings. They are actually a major food source. So it obviously doesn't work all the time. There are bats, for instance, that are called gleaners that will pick off moths at rest from leaf surfaces. So the moth isn't even flying. It's not detecting a flying object, it's detecting a moth sitting on the background clutter. They're very quiet flyers, these bats. They don't make very much noise themselves. They're listening for either the sounds of the moth moving, or in fact they're using their sonar to form a picture of what's there. Quite how other moths seem to manage it. I mean, there's obviously, if you take out the three groups that have got ears, well, there go the 90,000 just about. You take out the 18,000 butterflies that are flying by day and getting out of it that way. There are various other moths that get out of it by flying by day. There are hawk moths with ears. There are there are the aposematic ones as well. Really, you're not left with very much other than the Microlepidoptera at the end of it, and they presumably have their own defense mechanisms.
If you look at the wings underneath the bat roosts, is this sort of representative of the fauna in the area, or do you get particular?
It seems Vic was asking whether, in fact, there's any. Whether the moths underneath bat roost are representative fauna or selection thereof. It seems to be a selection. So, for instance, in this West African study, they found that the wings that were in the hawk moth wings that were in the bat roosts were the hawk moths that didn't have ears and didn't stridulate. So they seem to be specifically targeting those species that couldn't hear them coming. Chris Lyle was asking whether there's a bimodal distribution of scent organ size in Creatinotus. It seems not to be the case. It's a complete gradation through from virtually nothing all the way through to very large. It's all dependent on exactly how much of this pheromone precursor the caterpillar eats. So it's not just, and that itself depends on the plants that it feeds on, and also to a certain degree how much of the precursor a particular plant has, because of course not all plants are necessarily having equal amounts. So the result is this continuous distribution of sizes. I don't. Mickey Webb is asking whether, in fact, the fact that map butterflies lay their eggs in columns is an anti-parasitoid device, because parasitoids attack the egg on the leaf. The answer is I don't know. After all that, but it could quite well be the case.
So I think T.R. Bell made the experiment with this papilio labrum, which plays exactly like this. What the anopheles do is that they attack the first egg, and then he calculated that up to 95% of all the roots are gone, only 5% survive. It's the only oriental or two, a group of oriental sorcerers which they take on top of the exactly like the map.
Presumably they're related to the feed on plants that have these sticky latex things. Do they take any method of counteracting this, like sort of cutting off the channels before they chew the leaf or anything like that?
Vicky Stuff was asking whether the caterpillars that feed on latex-bearing plants have any means of circumventing being gummed up by the latex. Yes, they do. There are various methods that they can use. The characteristic one is to actually chew halfway through the leaf to cut the veins going into the leaf, so that all the leaf has is the latex that's already in there, and then they quite happily eat the rest of the leaf. There are some Plusiae noctuids in Hawaii that actually turn this to their advantage as young larvae. They will sit in the middle of the leaf and they will chew a circle around them, and the latex comes up out of this circle and forms a barrier, which the caterpillar then sits in the middle. It eats the leaf that's in the middle, quite protected from ants that can't get past this poisonous latex barrier that it's set up for itself. It only works, of course, when the caterpillars are quite small. When they're larger, they do away with this and start nipping the stem, the leaf stalks instead.
Right, if there are no more questions, of course, you can always think of something and catch in afterwards while we're having a drink. That brings us to the end of it. And thank you very much again.